Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast. I'm your host, John Lossoff. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
I had a crazy dream last night.
Tell us all about it.
So, I'm like on this prison island, right? And I'm walking, and I see this big crowd. So, you know, I'm curious. I walk up to this big crowd, and there's this guy in a sleeveless shirt and a beautiful mullet. And he's just dribbling around like a maniac. And he just drains this shot from half court.
Wow.
And I mean, it's pretty amazing. But then I kept walking and I see another basketball court. No one's there. And I see like this person that looks strangely like Christy Swanson in the 80s. And she takes this basketball and I think she's throwing a basket, you know, at the hoop, but she doesn't. She throws it and she hits this old lady in the head and this old lady's head just explodes. We're talking a basketball made a woman's head explode. So I'm like, I'm gonna get out of here. All right, I'm gonna get out. You know, my
dream. Watching a movie called Escape from Deadly Friend.
Yeah. And so I'm walking, right? And I'm like, I'm gonna get away from this, okay? And I look up and I see this werewolf bust through this window, right? And then the werewolf looks at me and goes, "I look great," and then flicks me off, right? A werewolf flicks me off, and then comes running straight at me. Then I woke up.
Wow.
Escape from your were-deadly friend.
Yeah.
This is what you dream about.
Yeah.
Wow. I just dream about being naked in a classroom. It's not. It's nowhere near as entertaining as your dreams.
That's all you dream about?
Yeah. I don't know.
Where are you naked, John?
In the classroom.
In your class?
In the classroom, in a restaurant, in the sky, in the forest. It's always a different place every night. Lemongood. John Lemongood. Tell everybody what you dream about.
Well, down here in the basement of the Movies, Films, and Flicks headquarters in the historic Film Archives Vault, we've actually come across two pieces of very alarming news in the last week.
Okay.
So, first off, heads up, everybody. As if we didn't see it coming one day, The Exorcist is actually going to be remade.
Really?
It's been announced that it's intended, but it hasn't been announced that it's go in terms of the script. And another thing is that with all the buzz about the Prometheus sequels, plural, and Neil Blomkamp's Alien 5, it seems that Prometheus wants to totally blur the lines between these two franchises by calling Prometheus 2 Alien Paradise Lost.
Huh. Now, I just had an idea.
That is the name of Prometheus 2.
I can't wait for
I just had an idea. What if someone, whoever's remaking Exorcist, I want him to do it in space. And I want Ridley Scott to direct it. Can you imagine that pea soup just flying everywhere in zero gravity? That would be so gross. That would be so gross.
You couldn't escape it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when most people puke, it's kind of like...
Don't go there. Don't
go
there.
If you're in, like, you know, what is it? I was going to say 3G.
Yeah, if you're in 3G coverage, you can, like, upload it really fast.
Yeah, when you're in no gravity, like, 0G, like, you're it's going to be floating everywhere. It's
going to
be bouncing off things. Like, you can't escape pea soup demon vomit.
I think that would be the scariest part of the movie, just them trying to avoid the pea soup in zero gravity. Like, oh, God, I'm just trying to, like, float over here, but it's not really working that way. And that jerk, like whoever is getting possessed, is just like, I'm going to get you.
Oh, you can imagine like someone drifting by in zero gravity. So like they're drifting across the screen, right? But as they're drifting across your TV screen, they're slowly spinning. But as their body is slowly spinning, as they're drifting across the TV screen, the head just keeps looking at you the whole time.
It's like, oh, no.
So the body is spinning instead of the head spinning.
Could it be like in space, everyone can hear you puke?
Yes.
Well, I mean, look, with Jason, it took 10 movies to go to space. With Leprechaun, it took like four movies to go to space. With Hellraiser, it took four movies to go to space. With Exorcist, we're looking at movie what, like seven? There's two prequels. There's three movies.
It'll be movie number six. It'll be six.
Movie number six. That's not bad. That's kind of like the middle ground of Jason and the other franchises. Yeah,
they're on schedule. They're on schedule.
Yeah. The Exorcist in space.
Yeah.
The
biggest problem I have is like gravity-less chase scenes might be the most boring thing ever. It's like, I think it's a toss-up between that and like a Wave Runner chase.
Yeah.
You know, like you have these very slow people moving through the spaceship. I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. No, you're not. No, you're not. I'm going to get you.
Okay, like maybe if like the gravity randomly turned on and off like during a chase scene, you know, some guys like he has like to jump like a huge chasm. And then like halfway through the jump, he's like gravity just turns off. And he's like, whoa, I'm just floating here. And then like he lands on the other side. Well, floats to the other side. Then like the guy follows suit and then just like. The gravity comes back on. It's like, I'll get you next time.
Could the Exorcist person use their head as like a propeller in space? Like,
oh my god, that would be so amazing to watch. Like, they would just like, they would automatically go faster. Whoever they're chasing.
So wait, is Exorcist in space basically Event Horizon Part 2?
Event Horizon Part 2, Jaws Part 7. What else?
Wicker Man 3.
Gremlins Part 9. Just, yeah. Yeah. No, I'm... Oh, man. I really want to see an Exorcist movie in space now.
Like, I want to pause the scene in Event Horizon and just see a little demon in the back of it going... with its little head.
I got you now! I got you now, baby!
I don't know why a demon's calling people baby.
I'm chasing you down, baby, with my head spinning.
is this a rock star demon?
Yeah. All right. Enough rock star demon babies.
Wait. What? But Leprechaun went to the hood. Can we have, like, Exorcist goes to, like, a hardcore concert or something like that? Or,
where everybody's like all straight edge.
White Tiger concert?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're straight edge. We're not about that pea soup. Anyway. Lemon good. I think it's time to start off the episode like we do every episode with listener questions. You got listener questions this week, right?
I do. My first question comes from a childhood friend of mine through Facebook. It's Chris from Virginia, originally from New Jersey, and he asks, so Kurt Russell caught a knife that Lo Pan threw at him in Big Trouble in Little China, and then he threw it right back at him. Who else could do that? And could Kurt Russell do that with a bullet?
Okay, so the first person that came to mind when I read this question is Drax the Destroyer from Guardians of the Galaxy. Mainly for the fact that he had that epic line. Where it's like, no, nothing goes over my head. My reflexes are too fast. So I feel like his reflexes would just also work in that regard.
I love that line. Nothing... I'd catch it.
Yeah.
just because he says it, we're just gonna like buy that.
Yeah.
I think he meant it.
Yeah.
I really do.
No, because like his character, he doesn't handle metaphors very well. He's a very literal person. So.
But can't he be wrong?
No, he's never wrong.
I mean, he earned the name Drax the Destroyer.
Yeah. This is the guy that
he didn't give that name to himself. Do you know why? Because after he fails to catch the knife and throw it and everyone laughs at him, he gets mad and destroys everything.
No, he'll catch it.
I think he would.
This is the guy that drunks call his enemies.
Yeah. He got drunk. He drunk dialed Ronan the Destroyer.
But Lazarus, more importantly, part two of that question, could Kurt Russell have pulled that same trick with a bullet?
Oh, yeah. There'd be like a lot of blood involved. But yeah. anybody could catch a bullet. It's just how committed are you?
Yeah. And really. Throw it back.
Yeah.
And like
it would take a while. He'd have to like dig through his body.
I'm just saying nothing's impossible. You just you know, how much do you want to commit to this idea?
So my only So Jack Burton's the greatest blowhard of cinema history. So I think the only two people that could catch a knife and kill an immortal named Lo Pan would be Ash from the Evil Dead series, Army of Darkness specifically. The guy's a complete idiot. He basically almost causes like a a skeleton apocalypse, but then he saves the day out of sheer idiocy. And I think he could maybe accidentally catch a knife and throw it back. And then MacGruber.
And MacGruber.
I think MacGruber is the biggest blowhard of all time. Oh, and he would be perfect with these two guys. I think he could catch a knife and then throw it back and then maybe kill an innocent victim next to the bad guy.
While he has celery sticking out of his butt.
Yeah, exactly. But only blowhards can do it. Like people who don't know any better. And then with the bullet, it would have to be Jack Burton could do it if he just got shot and then dig it out and throw it back. Or Ace Ventura. Because he caught a bullet in his teeth.
That's true. I saw it. Yeah. I saw him do it.
Yeah. And he's like a blowhard too. He doesn't know any better. So.
So the moral of the story is that if you're a blowhard, you can catch anything.
Yeah.
Which is weird because you're just blowing stuff. You're not really catching. I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. But you kind of get what the idea was supposed to be, right?
I mean, I get it totally, man.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, you just full of hot air. You know what I'm saying?
like the dude in Big Trouble in Little China, like that bad guy. He was full of hot air.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh,
he was yelling.
Nice.
Ah! And he's just like blowing up.
Yeah. And he was the cockiest out of all them. So, yeah, I like that. He had the longest, like, warm-up thing in front of Lopan. Like, he was full of himself, for sure.
He was blowing hard.
I mean, I would not want to be in front of him when he was blowing that air. Like, who knows?
Yeah. And then he explodes. Like, someone, like, overfilled a whoopee cushion. There's laps of him flying around. All right. So... for me, for the Lopan Kurt Russell knife catch and throw, I immediately thought of Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, in The Rundown. Because in The Rundown, he did like almost everything perfectly. And I feel like that's the character who would pull that off. And I guess you wouldn't be too angry about it.
So he would catch the knife, throw it back, and then he would write down like a little thing in his recipe book. Ooh,
about porcini mushrooms.
Yeah, I got to chop them up. With a knife.
Remind me to get that knife later.
Yeah,
that was my kitchen knife.
But the tough thing is, like, but could Kurt Russell have pulled his own knife trick with a bullet? And I was thinking, like, the only way that could happen, right, would be is if the silliest of all Kurt Russell characters ever was doing it by accident. So I imagine you got Captain Ron, right, and he's held at gunpoint because he found some kind of treasure by accident without even knowing it's valuable, and the guy who has the gun aimed at him is about to pull the trigger, but Captain Ron like slaps a mosquito, right, and then he trips or something and he falls out of the path of the bullet before the bullet shot just because he like stumbled like a fool, and then the bullet hits the mast of Captain Ron's ship and ricochets and hits the shooter in the leg. And why the leg? Because the shooter has to have full cognitive function to realize the stupid freak accident that just happened to him, just like when Martin Short saw Kurt Russell pull it through at the end of Curtin Ron for victory.
Now call me like crazy.
It's The Rock and Captain Ron.
Now call me crazy, but I always like to imagine Kurt Russell's character from Captain Ron. Like, I like to imagine his eye patch being bulletproof. Like, maybe he lost his eye, like, due to being shot, and he, like, learned his lesson, like, never again. So I'm
probably,
just kinda,
you know, we've mentioned that eye patch now on, like, three different podcast episodes.
So I like to imagine he wears, like, bulletproof eye patch. So, like, whenever someone is brandishing a gun at him, he's like, shoot me. And then he just tries to catch the bullet with his eye patch. And to ricochet it off and hit the guy.
I think that's in the director's cut.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, is Captain Ron a blowhard?
No, he was just like a typical like non-heroic fail-upper.
He had no blowhardness?
I don't think so. Like he was just covering his own ass when he was like, you know, trying to find his way through the Caribbean and like, yeah, I don't think there was any ego behind it. He was just embarrassed to admit he didn't know.
So he was deeply insecure?
Yeah, pretty much.
Doesn't sound like the Kurt Russell I know. Anyway, so the answer to the first question is just be a blowhard.
That's right.
Right? I think that's good enough.
Yeah.
For that question. Yeah.
Yeah. So the second listener question comes from Twitter. The Twitter listener is Chris Hickenbotham, which is at Chicken2000.
Oh, that guy.
And what's that?
I was like, oh, that guy.
Yeah. Chicken2000's all over my Twitter, I'm just going to say. But yeah, he's a good supporter. But Chicken2000 asks, Were any animals hurt in the filming of the 2006 horror movie Black Sheep? And for anyone listening right now, Black Sheep was a New Zealand horror movie about these sheep that got infected, basically became like flesh eaters, and at some point there was a were sheep zombie monster.
Yeah. And so I typed in, you know, animal death New Zealand, and a lot of Lord of the Rings stuff came up. But then I dug deeper into Black Sheep, and Weta did all the special effects. And I remember watching this movie back in the day thinking something was going to be really bad, but I watched it, and I remember it being a really good movie.
I love that movie. I think it's fantastic.
Weta, who did, like, The Host and Lord of the Rings and, like, some of the best special effects, I think Rise of the Planet of the Apes, some of the best special effects, did all the practical and digital effects for Black Sheep. So, I mean, maybe a trainer pulled a... Wait. What if a trainer is in one of the sheep and he pulls, like, a hammy?
So you're saying, wait, no, would it still be an animal at that point?
I mean, he's in character.
In character as an animal.
He or she's in character.
Right.
So they're going at the person in the puppet, and then their leg falls asleep, they stand up, and they roll an ankle.
So does PETA care?
Hold on. Would it have been enough to fool the Humane Society? You're like, no, shut it down. Shut it down. That sheep pulled its hamstring. Like, no, it's a guy.
It would have to take some serious convincing.
Right. I'm going to go with yes. Like, maybe...
Just
like,
go with yes or no. It's, like, true.
Maybe, like, a bug got stepped on. Someone's cat got sad that the owner had to leave. I don't know. I'm sure an animal got hurt.
Sad.
Yeah.
I mean, there were real sheep, and they were, like, doing little paintings on the sheep, so I'm sure the sheep got, like, stressed out.
Yeah. Yeah, animals, there were animals hurt. Not physically, but emotionally.
Do you think there was a sheep psychologist?
I hope so.
Like, Ricky's not feeling good today. He won't be on set.
There's a sheep psychologist on the set of every movie.
He's going to be in his trailer, because out of the 200 sheep that they had in the flock, they each have a little trailer.
22 Jump Street had a record number of sheep psychologists. Fun fact.
So the answer, like, I don't want to say it, guys. We don't do yes or no answers. So I'm going to say, here we go. One of the guys in one of the costumes blew out his hammy, and then he landed on a real sheep.
Yeah. And that made his sheep sad.
It Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, they see some injured animals, maybe black sheep. I mean, they had like 200 sheep, I think, on set.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think trainers fell on the sheep, and that's how the injuries happened.
Like, they slipped in sheep poo and landed on a sheep.
Yeah.
How crappy of a trainer would you have to be to just trip and fall on your animal?
Well, it has nothing to do with your training.
I'm just saying. Shouldn't you have, like, some sort... Shouldn't you have, like, enough experience not to do that?
Situational awareness is crap.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you slip on crap.
Maybe you're in the wrong profession.
Like, the choices were Navy SEAL or sheep trainer. I don't know how good your situational awareness is as a sheep trainer. Like, you don't have... It's not like training lions. You don't have to be on your toes.
Whoa. Remember the last time that you talked about sheep trainers? We got bombarded with emails. Didn't you have to go to, like, arbitration?
Yeah, let's not bring that up.
All right, sheep people, we love you. Don't sue us again.
Yeah.
We realize that it is a tough job, and sheep do bite and get stressed.
I want to see, like, the series of life decisions that lead someone to become a sheep trainer.
I think that's something
very unique set of decisions.
I think it's something you fall into. Like a sheep. A film is like, hey, we need sheep. Who owns sheep? Well, Hank owns sheep. They're like, Hank, you want to bring your sheep? Sure. Do you know how to train them? Sure. And then Hank becomes the sheep guy. You know what I'm saying? Then Hank has a cousin, Louise, who he can't make a shoot because he's, you know, on another shoot. So then she goes. So it's all like a family affair that they fell into.
So that makes me think of, like, the Batman Returns with Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. And when they were making that movie, they had trained cats on the set. And the trainer was using this clicker thing, like this little clicker. And I'm just wondering, like, what if that was the same situation? Like, yo, we need, like, 18 cats. He's like, I got 18 cats. I can make some money. He's, like, out of work or something. They're like, we need trained cats. He's like, well, yeah, they're trained. And he just has this little clicker thing, right? And so he's just like clicking around. The cats are running all over the place. And the director's like, I thought these were trained cats. He says, have you ever seen a trained cat before? These are trained cats. He's just clicking and just hoping the cats go in the right place.
In my head, I'm picturing that it all goes right for the guy. And he's just like, I can't believe this is working. I can't believe this is working.
Cream on Michelle Pfeiffer and clicks and they all run under her body when she falls off the building.
I just wanted to digress really quickly. I always thought it was really weird in that movie how Michelle Pfeiffer like goes flying through the glass. She lands like on the ground. And then like the cats lick her back to life. And all of a sudden she's Catwoman. Like that's really weird. I don't know.
And yet even though that turned her into Catwoman, the death that happened before she turned into Catwoman counted as one of her nine lives.
And it was just, why did she need an origin story? Why couldn't she just be like, hey, I'm a thief. Like, let's just go with that.
That was just an origin scene. It's Tim Burton. He doesn't think too deeply.
Catwoman doesn't need an origin story. She's a thief, a cat burglar, so to speak. That's enough origin. You don't need cats licking her back to life.
When Danny DeVito bit that guy's nose.
That was serious.
Batman Returns is a very dark movie in hindsight.
You know what's funny is that like Danny DeVito back then, like how like feral and insane he was. That's basically just his character on Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Okay.
It's just he's generally happier while he's that.
All right. So I think the answer to that question, were there any animals hurt in the making of Black Sheep?
Well, I still got my answer.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Okay, so
sorry, I got sidetracked by Michelle Pfeiffer.
There actually was a scene in this movie where you would question if an animal got hurt if you weren't paying like really, really close attention. Because at one point, a sheep is near a candle, and the sheep bursts into flames. Like, its wool touches the candle, it bursts into flames. And so I read about this online. It turns out that, like, so wool ignites at a really, really high temperature, and it has a really, really low burning rate. So that wouldn't even have really happened if you put a candle right to a sheep. Like, it wouldn't burst in flames and go running away like a little fireball like it did in the movie. Instead, like, you'd light the sheep, and it's like lighting a piece of firewood. Like, you hold the fire to it for, like, 2 minutes, and then it's got these little red cinders. And, like, maybe after a few minutes, the sheep might, like, twitch its head a little bit, like, what's that smell? Am I on fire?
Oh, shit.
That would be it. As it turns out, I could find no record, by the way, when I looked online either, of any animals actually being hurt in making that movie.
That's good.
I bet somebody blew their hammy out.
Yeah. All right, so the answer to that question is a blown hamstring and feral and insane Danny DeVito. All right. I think that slightly answers that question. And thanks again, guys, for those amazing listener questions. I think, time to move on to the topic of the day. Mark, I think you've got that for us today.
Wait, I do?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right, no, so...
right?
Okay. it's a sad day, everybody. And, you know, if you guys... you know, a lot of people talk about Wes Craven as a horror director, but I feel like any cinemaphile, anybody who knew anything about movies knows the name Wes Craven. The guy is synonymous with horror. He's a maestro, and he passed away recently. And today's podcast is just kind of go through his films. We're going to go through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, and just kind of talk about the impact he had on horror. And I mean, this is a guy who revolutionized horror in the 70s with The Last House on the Left, and then he revolutionized horror with The Nightmare on Elm Street in the 80s, and then he revolutionized horror in the 90s with Scream, and his impact was felt, you know, right up until he passed. So today's pod is just going to talk about Wes Craven, his influence, and the lasting legacy that he made upon the horror scene.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So born in 1939, what I find most interesting about Wes Craven is that this is a guy who grew up in a very strict Baptist upbringing. He didn't watch a movie till he was in college. He was very literate. He read throughout his youth. You know, he had some experience around 8mm cameras when he was younger. And he went all the way through grad school, began teaching, and then he made the switch into production. He became a messenger for a post-production house after grad school. He drove a cab. Then he met a guy named Sean. Well, he had some dalliances into porn as well. But he met a guy named Sean Cunningham. They got $90,000 from this Boston drive-in theater company, and they made their first movie, The Last House on the Left. And what I love most about Wes Craven is this is a guy who he didn't really have cinematic influences because he wasn't really able to watch movies until he was in late college. So this is a guy who, you know, was very literate, very smart, anti-violence, and he found his way into horror. So as opposed to like copying other people's horror, his films, early films, set the bar in realism and really sort of changed the landscape of horror in the 1970s.
Yeah, and for listeners who aren't familiar with it, like he wasn't allowed to watch movies as a child. That was kind of like a very strict house rule. So it wasn't some coincidence or he just didn't see a lot of movies. He was prohibited from seeing movies.
Yeah, and you know what I love, though? When he did make his first movie, he kind of based it off Bergman's The Virgin Spring. So here's a guy who's making one of the arguably nastiest, grossest, verite, real horror films of all time, and he's basing it off of, you know, The Virgin Spring. And so this is like a guy who brought a lot of intelligence into horror and character and realism. And if you think about horror at that time, you know, he brought a realism back into horror. And later on, like there's an article where they're saying Last House made it legitimate for the real world approach to dread, a concept that would be embraced by both conventional The Exorcist and Omen and independent The Texas Chainsaw Massacre entertainment element. No longer was a supernatural situation required. All you needed were the realness of life amplified through the thriller chiller ideal, and bang, instant homegrown horror. So this guy who grew up in a strict Catholic, you know, or Baptist upbringing, never watched movies, quit teaching to work for no money delivering films, was given $90,000 and he revolutionized horror.
So I have a question. Do you think his lack of movie watching experience or just lack of exposure to movies, do you think that actually helped in regards to kind of the visceral, you know, realistic violent experience of his early movies? Like, say, like, he wasn't swayed by like the kind of campy early horror movies. Like, he was just like, he was just inspired by real life.
Yeah, you know? I think he was.
Well, it certainly would have facilitated originality.
Yeah. I've never seen a movie before, but I'm going to make one. Let's see what happens.
And that's what they did. And it was just like a few crew members. This is what he said. It was just two guys, me and Sean Cunningham. He happened to own an editing machine, and someone offered him money. They wanted a scary movie for their theater chain to show as a second feature. So we didn't know anything about making real movies. We didn't know anything about the movie world. We didn't know anything about Hollywood or rating systems, anything. We just made what we thought would be a scary movie, so we weren't thinking about it in any way except getting the movie done. With a crew of, I think, 8 to 6 actors, it was all very basic. We never thought about anything beyond the day. So these guys, yeah, I think you're right. So Lazabeth, to answer your question, he had no influences. So this was his. This was like, I know this sounds weird, but it was a pure filmmaking experience. It was these people, and like we've talked about Night of the Living Dead in our Romero pod. It was like a happy, happy accident. And like director Ang Lee, who's won Oscars, I believe, he said that The Last House on the Left is one of the greatest films ever. And he's like, and now that I've seen it, it should be banned.
So it's rare for a horror movie to watch a horror movie that doesn't really draw on other influences, or rather the influences
it's influences in storytelling, because he was very, very well read. It's not borrowing from horror movies.
Right.
Yeah, it came from The Virgin Spring by Bergman.
Right. So,
but I mean,
no.
Yeah.
You know, so he was doing a Q&A at some point several years ago, and he had said something like, it was a time when every time someone got stabbed or shot, they just fell to the ground dead. And if you're doing a scary movie where the whole purpose of the movie is people dying or the threat of people dying, it needs to happen slowly. And this movie is his first movie, and it's a testament to this notion because, you know, this woman is she meets an unfortunate band of individuals. She's
Do you want to break down the plot?
Well, I'm just going to say she's raped and left for dead, and it turns into a revenge movie. But when she's left for dead, she's crawling. And just to see her, the first scene of her crawling when you know she's still alive, I mean, it takes her about 3 minutes of screen time to move 18 inches. And then eventually she gets her strength back. And then later when she's getting her revenge, when she stabs somebody, they just, you know, they're slowed down. They're not down for the count and out. So he really did a lot to dramatize injury in movies, what would otherwise be potentially lethal injuries in film.
So Eli Roth and Takashi Miike owe a lot to Wes Craven.
Oh yeah,
early Wes Craven.
And like, so he did, you know, remember like old westerns when people got shot and they'd grab the wound and go and then they'd fall down and die. So we can thank him for that, but we can also thank him for the Luke Wilson scene in Vacancy where he gets stabbed 47 billion times, bleeds out for 8 hours, and Lazavath and I watch this movie, and Lazavath's like, don't do it, Luke Wilson.
Don't do it.
And all of a sudden, Luke Wilson goes, I'm like, what? He's been bleeding out for 8 hours, and he just got gutted. But so, Lazavath, you just watched The Last House on the Left. What were your thoughts about it?
It was the first time I watched the movie. It was back in high school. I think like maybe freshman year. I think it was the period of my life where I was just going to like really old horror movies I'd never seen before. I'm thinking like, oh man, this is pretty gross, and like I never saw it again. I didn't really give it much time to kind of sink in. I'm watching it now, and it's crazy how effective the movie is. Having seen it recently, like I know what's gonna happen. Like I know what's coming, but it's still, you get this kind of dirty feeling just watching it, you know. It's like this.
And this is 1972. A lot of old movies, you know, they don't hold their impact.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, I'm reminded of movies that are coming out today that kind of are, that want to do the same thing that Last House on the Left did. And it just, you don't feel the same impact. Like the newer movies, they're more graphic, they're more violent, but it's just, you don't have that kind of visceral kind of dirtiness that comes from watching this movie. The other movies are just kind of depressing to watch because they're just not good movies, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, there's that scene in the movie where, like, the family, what's the name of the guy, the leader of, I forgot his name on The Last House on the Left, Krug?
Krug or Klug, yeah.
And there's that scene where they're kind of, like, laughing, and then they kind of just stop and they realize what they did. And there's, like, a look of, like, not shock on their faces, but, like, depression. So you have these villains who do this heinous act, and then they kind of think about it a little bit. Like, do you remember that scene where they're just kind of, like, standing around?
Oh,
and then
yeah.
They just react to it, and, like, there's, like, almost hurt in their eyes. So, like, this movie wasn't, like, black and white. I mean, not literally, but it wasn't black and white violence. It was very gray. And then you move into the revenge part of the film where the parents just whoop ass. And, I mean, that's dirty and grimy, too. So, like...
Yeah. Well, yeah. You never really feel good about what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, just like, oh, I mean, I'm glad they're getting revenge, but you could have just called the cops or something.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, this is going to come up a couple times in this podcast, and we brought it up before when we were talking about the original Poltergeist, but there was an interesting thing about when this movie was released and dealing with the MPAA rating board. Because originally they wanted this, they were just saying, you can't show this, this is an R, this is X. And so if you want to release this, and they said all the things that he had to cut when they submitted it to this to the MPAA board, they basically wanted to cut 50% of the running time of the movie. And so he just took another movie with the negative reel of the MPAA R rating and clipped it on, and that's how they showed the movie. If he didn't break the law, literally break the law, such that he should have gone to jail, but he just didn't get caught. Like, if he didn't do that, no one would have seen this movie. And then years later, all these people who would have condemned him for it, like, are kind of praising this cavalier rather than criminal action. And but like this was unheard of. This was unacceptable. People were evidently rioting. I read about it after seeing this movie and threatening lives, including the filmmakers, and they wanted to burn all the negatives.
Yeah,
and here we are talking about it like it's great. You know, yeah.
It was a love hate for sure. Ebert loved it, and he hates horror movies, so that's kind of cool. But you know what I think it did that messed with a lot of people? If you think a lot about early horror films, you never had like the nuclear family in the suburbs getting killed. You know, you had, you know, in Hitchcock, you had a thief running away. You know, you had, you know, femme fatales. You had criminals getting their comeuppance. You had, you know, monsters causing mayhem. But you never had like a family in the suburbs. And I think that's what Wes Craven with this and Hills Have Eyes really like brought to the world, was like these nuclear families could get lit up.
So he wanted to hit close to home, literally. Yeah.
So I mean,
sneaky bastard.
I mean, how many people walking through the woods after they watched that movie, you know, weren't looking behind their shoulder? So yeah, cool. So yeah, so Last House on the Left was his first film. And that leads us into The Hills Have Eyes, which, you know, another nuclear family goes the wrong way, and they go off the beaten track, and a bunch of inbreds wreak havoc on them. I'm coming back for you, girly. And I don't know. He does stick with what I noticed about Craven, though, and he'll say it himself, he does stick with family a lot. You know, you had the family on Last House on the Left. You had the family in Hills Have Eyes. So he does, you know, flirt with that dynamic a lot. And, you know, eventually the ties get turned and the dog, you know, kills some people. And, I mean, that's another movie that shocked and appalled people in 77.
Yeah. I can see why go ahead, Levengood.
Oh, no, I was just going to make the quick point that unlike The Last House on the Left, the original Hills Have Eyes is a movie where when I rewatched it actually somewhat recently, it had almost no impact on me. For me, the impact was purely historic and realizing what hadn't yet been done back then and why it was shocking back then. But when I rewatched this, it had almost no shock value or impact on me, whereas Last House on the Left maintains a serious, visceral, primal, emotional impact on me.
I mean, there's that guy in Hills Have Eyes who has, like, the bandana with the little bones on it. I'm like, who sews the bones on his bandana? Like,
his mom.
Who's doing – yeah, his mom. Like, who's doing these guys' wardrobes? Like, they were very stylish. But, like, there's that scene, though, in Hills Have Eyes where that guy shoots the women in the trailer. Like, if you're sitting there in 77 and you see that scene, you're like, what?
Just right, and it's daylight. You're like, it's daylight most of the movie, too.
Did women just get – shot, and then the guy threatened to come back for the other girly? Like,
whoa.
That's like an intense movie in 77.
Yeah.
Where were you going?
Oh, I was going to say, like, I can see why he stuck with the family dynamic. The family dynamic just pulls at the heartstrings more. If it was just like a group of, like, you know, college roommates or just like a bunch of frat guys, like, them dying, it's like, oh, okay. I mean, who's the next person that's going to die? But if it's an actual family, it's like when someone loses their daughter or someone loses their dad, it's just like, oh, no. Because you can see the emotion on the other characters' faces because that's someone they actually cared about. And that works great for horror movies, you know?
Yeah.
When you just can pull at the heartstring, it's like, oh, man, that's just going to make him even more invested in these characters. And that'll make him even more scared as the movie goes on.
Well, you know, and we've talked a lot throughout the episodes about the importance of, you know, being able to recognize a character's name. But when you use a family and you know that the characters are families, it kind of gives you as the filmmaker a little bit of the upper hand as long as you treat it right. Because even if I don't remember the names of the characters, when someone dies, there's an urgency because I say, oh, my God, that was his son.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like I understand the connection instead of just, oh, that was bro number 8.
No.
Which he did in Hills Have Eyes too.
Yeah, pretty much.
But no, what I yeah. So what was I going to say? Oh man, I had a great point. I'll find it later.
Just go for the steal. If you don't got anything, I'll go for the steal.
Oh yeah, go for the steal. I'm going to John Stockton assist Carl Malone.
So the steal is that 1972, Last House on the Left. Also 1972 Deliverance, 1977 The Hills Have Eyes. We've got two Appalachian and one desert where we have weird kind of either hillbilly, redneck, or low-class people as our foes, as the antagonists. Was that the dawn of that?
Freaks, right? Was Freaks, well, I guess that was about like circus folk. But yeah, I think it might have been.
But they were actually monstrous in appearance. So the new Hills Have Eyes movies, they're inbred and monstrous. Like they've been inbred to the point that they're inhuman. Whereas in this Hills Have Eyes, they seem very human. They just seem feral and they're predatory. You know,
was Dan DeVito among them?
No, he's not. He's not. Yeah, but new Hills Have Eyes, the new ones, I don't even remember them having much in terms of verbal skills. Whereas this old one, they're speaking fine.
Oh, and you know what though, in the Hills Have Eyes remake, there's a scene where, you know, they have all these deformed people, and then there's one guy with like a trench coat. So there's all these inbred people, and then they cut to this one inbred guy who's just wearing a trench coat, and that's it. Like they must have been too lazy to put makeup on him that day. It really took me out of the movie. But what I was going to say is, what Last House on the Left and Hills of Eyes did was something that's very important for the rest of Wes Craven's career. He got actors and actresses to fully immerse themselves in these roles. I mean, these people were rolling in blood and guts, and like they were getting involved in some like legit stuff in these films that might not work today. But he gets actors to really overperform and sell his work. And I think that's one of Wes Craven's best assets, is the performances he can get from his actors.
That's what Sam Raimi does to his actors.
No, he puts them through. Well, I think Sam Raimi does it because he just like likes to beat up on Bruce Campbell.
And Alison Lohman.
Yeah, I think he just finds people he's annoyed with and just pummels them for an hour and a half.
Sounds about right. All right, so to preface that, Evil Dead was awesome the way it was awesome because Sam Raimi didn't like Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
He's put him through the ringer. Bruce Campbell beat him in poker the first day before filming. So Raimi's like, yo, special effects guys, come here. Come on, yeah. Let's talk.
Never be friends with Sam Raimi is the moral of that story.
And then, he will put you through the ringer. And then I would have to, you know, so the next film is Swamp Thing in 82, one of the first superhero, you know, DC comic adaptations. That did all right. It's becoming a cult classic. But then the next one I kind of want to talk about is, John, you wrote a review about this, is Deadly Blessing.
Uh-oh.
And now Deadly Blessing, all right, it's Wes Craven light, all right? But I do think there are some important aspects in here. They had the bathtub scene, which he perfected.
With a python in it, yeah.
And then he had the elements of Christianity, correct?
Right. Which kind of, and in the bathtub scene, it emulated the Nightmare on Elm Street scene with the claw coming out in the bathtub between the legs. But this is before that, and it had the snake head coming out of the water between the girl's legs in the bathtub. But as it turns out, Nightmare on Elm Street was shopped around for about 3 years before it got picked up for theatrical review. So he made these movies around the same exact time.
Oh, so I mean, do you think he was just working the kinks out? Like he was? Do you think he was working some religious stuff out with Deadly Blessing? And like, you know, he had the dreams, which came into play in Nightmare on Elm Street.
This movie was working all of the kinks out, and by kinks I mean flaws, because this movie is to Wes Craven what Flash Gordon is to Lord of the Rings. Like, this was a completely bonkers-tastic, off the wall. I mean, allegedly there's a plot, but it's really just all over the place with elements. Too much is jammed into it. Now, I love this movie. It's got a lot of zaniness, and it's got a lot to appreciate. But I mean, it's like there are spiders in this movie because back then spiders were scary. Even if you just put the camera on a spider in the light and it's just sitting there doing spider
didn't
shit.
Didn't Sharon Stone have like a, it was Sharon Stone, yeah? And didn't she Sharon have Stone, a tarantula yeah. on her?
At some point a tarantula does, or a spider crawls in her mouth.
So, I mean, how does he do this with his actors?
Like, and it looks like she really does it, but you know what? The angle is so perfect that it's almost like when there's like a projectile vomit scene and you know there's a hose on the other side of their head.
Is there gravity? Is there gravity?
Oh, is there yeah.
And are they in space?
Zero gravity spider swallowing? But no, like, so But yeah, so it dealt with dreams a little bit. It dealt with ghosts at the very end of the movie. It kind of like a nihilistic ending where a ghost warns you, but you die anyway. It's again kind of like Nightmare on Elm Street, where, you know, you think you beat Freddy and then the mother dies and then there's a ghost at the end. So, I mean, there's things all over the place. There's spiders in this because spiders are scary. There's snakes in this because snakes are scary. How Hittites, who, according to Sharon Stone in this movie, make the Amish look like rock stars or porn stars or something. But, you know, like,
or so make that's them look like never been said before, ever.
The line was like the Hittites make the Amish look like swingers. And so, like, so these people aren't going to pet stores to get their tarantulas and boa constrictors. So in this movie, it's as if boa constrictors and tarantulas are wandering the cornfields in Nebraska. So, and like, there's, like, the moral of this movie in terms of zany things that happen is that if you put 18 chickens in a coffin, I assure you it will be terrifying for the next person who opens that coffin. Because they're just going to come, like, this movie that seem totally senseless, but the movie is hilarious today. And back then, before moviegoers knew better, there were a lot of shocks and a lot of there was a huge diversity of effects and scares. And there was, like, Sleepaway Camp, there was someone who turned out to actually be a man when we thought it was a woman the whole time. Yeah. So, like, all this weird stuff happens.
I think he's just working stuff out.
It's lunacy. But, yeah, so there's the Hittite dad who's very controlling.
Borgnine.
Right? He's basically, like, cock-blocking his Hittite-turned-social son. And they keep accusing his girlfriend of being an incubus, which is funny because incubus is the male iteration of a succubus. But so they're kind of misusing that word, unless they're referring to him as the incubus. They use the word incubus so much that you don't know what they're referring to half the time. Like, they could be the chickens in the coffin.
Can you pass me that incubus?
Yeah. What's that looking incubus got there?
Can I just ask, though? So I'm mentioning weird things in this movie, and I've seen this movie twice. And most people would have never seen it. But so, again, there's a scene where someone opens a coffin and, like, 18 live chickens just erupt out of it. Like, they were trained to scare you if you open the coffin. For what logical reason ever in any horror story would someone put a dozen or so live chickens in a coffin?
What if the guy in the coffin's a zombie and he wants some snacks?
There's no body. It's just chickens in the coffin.
Maybe they're in timeout.
I guess so, man. Like,
I want to
Reggie, Steve, Rick, Deborah.
I want to imagine the cat trainer from Batman Returns. His first job was the chicken trainer for this movie.
You know, this was another movie that made me think of, like, 80s and 70s action movies, because this movie, like, just followed the rule where if fire even briefly touches a car, it will explode. It will explode.
All right. So, you know, moving on from the classic Deadly Blessing, which, John, 4 out of 4 stars? How many? Wait, 12 out of 12 chickens?
12 out of 12 chickens, for sure. It gets all 12 of those chickens.
Because it's a dozen chicken eggs, get it, right?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I was trying to make a joke there, but I got nothing.
That's all.
So moving on, I just want to read one thing about Wes. So we're through the 70s, all right? He revolutionized horror. He made it real. He kind of sparked a revolution. Now, by this time that he released this movie in 84, there was already Halloween and a couple other films. But I just want to read you something. This is what Wes was talking about if he's talked to film students. He said, "I think bottom line, the advice I would give is don't duplicate what you've seen before. That seems to be the primary mistake that young filmmakers make. So you have to keep your head up and ask, have I seen this before? And if I have, go someplace else. Do something different." And then he talks about one more thing. "But it has to do with making people real. I think more than anything else, you can have a movie where you kill people by the billions and it'll become, like Stalin says, one person dies and it's a tragedy. 1 million people die and it's a statistic. So it starts to lose the effectiveness unless those are real people." So in his first couple films, or, you know, several films, there's not that high a body count. And the reason I'm bringing this up is when we move into A Nightmare on Elm Street in 1984, there isn't that much death in the film. But the deaths that do happen are incredibly effective. So what do you guys think about that? It's not an out-and-out slasher. I think it uses its violence well.
I mean, I would have liked, even though he doesn't want to reuse things, it would have been nice if before he killed Johnny Depp, that 18 chickens came out of a coffin to scare me as a red herring to lower my guard. But no, I mean, that's a good point. The deaths in Nightmare on Elm Street are not numerous, but it, specifically in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, above all the others, and I'll even say above all the Jason movies and even the Halloween movies, Halloween above Jason, but Freddy above both of them, that this first movie, the first Noise movie, has the most harrowing death scenes. Tina spinning around in the air across the room and across the ceiling as her boyfriend watches gashes open in her body, followed by the body bag dream sequence being dragged by an invisible force. The hanging in the prison cell, with this, it's just an animated, whatever, bed sheet being pulled by a string, obviously by, you know, today's moviegoers' eyes. But like, It was something never seen before, and even today, it's a little eerie, to be honest. And like these scenes, and those boiler room scenes, and the screeching—it's timeless. The screeching and the silhouette and the weird laugh. That movie, harrowing is the word. My nipples got hard just talking about it. I'm spooked.
Thanks for mentioning your nipples.
Yep. I see it.
Chest tingles and stuff. I wouldn't mean for that to sound like dirty. Like that wasn't the.
It looks like Levengood's. He's Levengood's lifting up his shirt. Looks like he got some stale pepperonis there.
Think Randy Quaid from Kingpin.
Yeah.
Right now.
Oh,
but the cookies. Right.
So, Nightmare on Elm Street tells the age-old story of a man who was killed, a child molester who was killed by parents, and this child molester comes back to haunt the children of the parents that killed him. And this is actually based on a true story that Wes Craven heard about a guy that wouldn't go to sleep because he knew he would die. And then he stayed up for days, went to sleep, then died. And also there was a traumatic moment from his childhood where this guy walking, he was staring out the window, and some grimy-looking dude walked by, stared at him, ran up to the window, smiled at him, went into his building, and then his brother went out to find the guy and they never saw him again. But between that story and a childhood trauma, this film, like, you could tell that Wes loved it, and you could tell he was hitting on all cylinders with this character. And another cool thing, I don't know if you guys know, but originally they were looking for, like, stuntmen to play Freddy, but they're all too, like, graceful. And then he came along, Robert Englund, who, you know, when I first watched this movie, I thought he was really goofy. But now that I watch it, I think there's something more disturbing in his lack of grace.
Yeah, you need that awkwardness. And when he's chasing Tina down the alley in her initial dream sequence, because when the movie starts, we're getting this girl Tina's dreams. You'd think that she was going to be the hero. That's another thing. You would assume she's the final girl or that she's going to die right away. It would be one or the other, right, in a movie. She's the final girl or she dies right away so that you know Freddy means business. And she dies like 30 minutes after this initial dream sequence where Freddy is chasing her down an alley and he's just a silhouette. And he's like chasing her kind of like a crab side to side with a limp. And even though it's kind of silly, you know, it's kind of dorky looking, it's very awkward, and it almost makes you, like, more uncomfortable.
Yeah. And that claw hand that Robert Englund had was pretty heavy, so he purposely walked with his shoulder down a little bit to kind of give his character something. Oh, and, of course, nice. His sweater, like, were, like, the two colors that were difficult for the human retina. And so also one cool thing is Robert Englund was completely okay with being evil. Like, they wanted it to be an old guy, but they were, like, too sensitive, and Robert Englund had no problem just being a terror. Like, Freddy was not misunderstood. He was an evil, evil, evil man. And like, there's a quote from Rob Zombie, who I could listen to him talk all day, but listen to us instead. Rob Zombie's like, it's easy to forget because Freddy Krueger turned into a lovable Halloween costume, but Nightmare on Elm Street is a dark, nasty, brutal film.
Right.
You know, it was.
It kind of brings up, like, something I wanted to say about Nightmare on Elm Street. I think this movie is definitely a departure from his previous movies, but at the same time, not really. I think what makes this movie so effective for me is that it has this very obviously surreal quality, you know, because of the concept and the character. But at the same time, that surrealism that it deals with, there's that same visceral kind of violence, that kind of realistic kind of griminess that was present in his earlier movies. So you have like these like surreal just kind of scenes, but there's like kind of a realness to them, like kind of, and that just makes it all scarier. Like it's like it's, there's like weird things going on, but it feels real, you know, and it just scares you that much more because you're not really understanding what you're seeing right now.
And yeah, I think it remains really haunting for me. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, Lazavath, but do you remember when Zach and I showed up at the movie theater and you were there with Morgan to watch Nightmare on Elm Street? It was probably 2004, so it was like the, you know, 20-year anniversary.
Yeah, yeah, there was a special screening at like at a theater in Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah, we
lovely,
drove an
lovely
hour.
City, by the way.
Yeah, we drove really. Over an hour to see Nightmare on Elm Street on the big screen for the 20th anniversary.
Right, right. No, it was a lovely time, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie is like super creepy. I mean, it's kind of part of what I would almost call like the silver age of horror, well after we've departed from like the Hammer film era. It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that was blunt force trauma, holy shit traumatizing. Like you left there like with a ghost face, but it's not like it was creepy necessarily. It was just it was like Saw before there was Saw and Hostel before there was Hostel. It was so brutal.
Draining.
Then you had Poltergeist in 82. That was like the next real pinnacle movie for me in this kind of silver age. And that, you know, had like Spielberg's influence, and it was very touching. It was like an emotional experience. And even though there was fear, it was fear from like a wholesome place. And then you go to this, and this is just that kind of otherworldly and haunting and creepy. So, like, these three movies, like, I'm sorry, people can go up and down all they want about Jason or Halloween. I'm sorry, I don't feel it. These three, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist, and Nightmare on Elm Street, you watch those three, those three are your intro to modern horror.
Also, one final point about Nightmare on Elm Street. Probably one of the best death scenes in the horror cinema history of Johnny Depp as he gets pulled into the bed.
Oh, yeah.
And then you see, like, the blood just kind of, like, spilling up. It was just that... That was art. I'm sorry. Like, it was... Sure, it might have been gruesome, might have been disgusting, but it was just beautiful. The way it was just shot and framed, it was just like... Yeah.
There's a documentary on Netflix that's 4 hours long, and they talk about how they did that. They had a rotating room.
Really?
Which, like, you know, Inception years later. Yeah, and yeah, watch it. It's called Never Sleep Again, I believe. And they talk about, like, the blood went everywhere. People got soaked in blood. The thing got stuck. All the crew members holding the room got covered in blood. The camera got covered in blood. And so all the crazy effects, there was in a spinning room. And they used the same room for the one, I forget her name, the first girl's death. Tina. Blonde. So they use the room twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to check out that documentary. But in the meantime, why don't you guys listen to some commercials? We'll be right back.
Hey, guys. Kurt Russell here. Actually, no, I'm joking. It's Mark. It's not Kurt Russell. I know a lot of you people believe that, but it's Mark, not Kurt Russell. But yeah, for you guys, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you've heard this book before. It's called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It is written by Jason Zinnemann, and it is a fantastic book that I absolutely recommend that you check out on Audible. It's not that long. It's 8 hours, 56 minutes. It's a beautiful book about the creation of modern horror. They go through Romero, Wes Craven, De Palma, Toby Hooper. I mean, this is a fantastic book that you should absolutely take advantage of this. You know, sign up for the free 30-day trial. You will get this book, and if you are a horror fan, you will love it. It breaks down modern horror. So
Just to go over it one more time, for you, the listeners, to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook. Shock value. Get it.
Hey, podcast listeners. Robert here, along with Kyle.
What's up?
And John.
Hey.
We're here to talk to you about a little podcast that we do called Shark Dropper.
Yeah.
What do we talk about in Shark Dropper?
Oh, all kinds of things. Kyle, name one of them.
Oh, geez. Walking across America.
John, name another.
Ooh, video games.
No, we never talk about that.
Yeah, that's stupid.
So if you want to listen to Shark Dropper, don't listen for the video
games. We talked about video games last week.
You know what? Just don't listen to John at all.
John, just don't listen to him talk.
Okay.
Yeah. that's a good rule of thumb.
But if you want to listen to me and Kyle talk, along with John intermittently, but really don't listen to that part.
Hi, guys.
Go visit sharkdropper.com because you can find everything there.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. Mark, I went to go look up that Netflix documentary, Never Sleep Again. I didn't find it because I got sidetracked, and I ended up watching the first four episodes of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Really, really funny show. So to all you Nightmare on Elm Street fans, check out Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. This is another Tina Fey hit.
Great bunker work. The bunker work in the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is...
I love the intro. The intro is kind of... It just fits the show somehow.
Yeah. I mean, anyway. It's all very dreamy and surreal.
Yeah.
I mean... You know, it could fit in the same world as Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, let's go with that. Anyway, Lemon Good, I think you have our final listener question today.
I do. Third question comes from Facebook. It's actually another acquaintance of mine. David from Fort Lauderdale asks, what is the most underrepresented group in zombie movies? Nazis? Asians? Vegans?
Eskimos? Inuit.
Oh, for the win. I think you just absolutely answered that question.
Oh, okay. I'll tell you who the most underrepresented group is. It's the Asians who were Nazis and also vegans. Right? You never see those guys in zombie movies. Where's the representation?
If either Kung Fury or Manborg had any Asians playing Nazi zombies, then you are blitzed.
Were they also vegans? Exactly.
Could be.
Exactly. It's just the NAV group, it's just they've been very patient, but it's reaching a tipping point.
So John,
they demand their own movie.
Is that your answer or are you joking right now?
John, like, you're in a bunker. You're in Kimmy Schmidt's bunker.
Yes.
And
Kimmy Schmidt's bunker.
And a Japanese Nazi vegan
right
comes at you. Will you be so shocked you can't fight it? Or do you think you could put it down pretty easy? Or would you be like just blown away?
Well, how do you know it's also a vegan? Does it have kale hanging out of its mouth?
Yes, it does.
Yes.
It has. So,
well, no, I wouldn't be scared. I wouldn't be scared because, like, a vegan zombie, like, what's it going to eat? Not me. I'm not a vegetable. You know.
Wait, if you're
I'm
a vegan kale. And you become a zombie, do you stick like in? You know what I mean?
I feel like they would. I feel like they would just to you know, just because they just want to let everybody know, like, oh, I may be dead, but I'm still eating healthy.
Wait, hold on. You know what happens is if someone really was a lifetime vegan and then they
why wouldn't they be vegans in the afterlife?
If someone really was a vegan for like 20 years, a devout vegan, they never faltered, and they ate a piece of meat, I think that they'd be so like just blood furiously frenzied with how delicious it is. They'd just be intoxicated. They would just start eating people.
See,
they've been eating crap for 20 years.
I don't think that would happen because, you know, vegans, they love to tell other people how much they're vegans. So I feel like when they become a zombie, they'll probably just annoy the other zombies. Like, God, you guys are eating like other people. Kale is where it's at. Come on. Don't eat your friends.
Yeah, like he has a little shovel and he drives a little leaf around.
Yeah.
And,
I really used to think that our podcast was really friendly to all audiences. We don't swear that much. We don't really talk about nasty stuff too much. But, Lazabeth, you have just proven that we are actually vegan unfriendly.
Well,
not friendly to vegans.
If you give any podcast enough time, it eventually becomes vegan unfriendly. That's my...
we are a vegan intolerant.
That's the last principle. Give a podcast enough time, it'll eventually become vegan unfriendly.
Wait, I have nothing against vegans. I just have something against zombie vegans.
Right. There you go.
Wait, well, no, hold on. But my favorite zombie in all of Dawn of the Dead was the Hare Krishna, and they're vegans.
And he wanted to eat flesh.
Well, because he got a taste of it, and he realized, what have I been doing with my life?
That's a movie. I'm just saying in real life.
It's a movie about a vegan zombie. That zombie gets more screen time than any other zombie. That's basically his life story.
During a real-life zombie apocalypse, the vegans will turn to zombie vegans, and they will just annoy the other normal zombies. I'm just saying, like, guys, you're eating the wrong thing. The kale. The dead kale. You got to eat this. I'm like, no, kale's gross. I don't want to eat it at all, alive or dead.
To be fair, I think there are a couple vegan zombies that are probably like, hey, don't lump me in with them. Like, I don't push my, you know, I don't push my veganism on other people. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're the cool vegans.
It occurs to me that if you don't count Asian horror movies, there are very, very few Asian zombies, I'm guessing. I can't think of any Asian zombies in mainstream American film releases.
In Fear the Walking Dead, they just had an Asian zombie.
Oh, no.
Right. Eskimos.
You think
it's all about those Eskimos?
Okay.
Inuits.
So if there are vegan zombies, would there be zombies out there who still eat meat, but only if it was free range and organic?
Yes.
So like, they wouldn't eat you if you just kind of sat in your room all day, you like eating Fritos. They would only eat the guys who just like ran around a field all day, like eating like kale.
Yeah, if you bunkered up, they don't eat the people who are in bunkers.
Yeah, they want to eat the guys who get a lot of exercise, get a lot of fresh air, eat plenty of oats.
Yeah, grass.
Yeah.
Do you think they like leave trails of oats for hungry people, and they just sort of follow them while they range and eat oats?
I don't know. I don't know the tactics of zombie hunters.
So wait, actual zombie hunters, like not people who hunt zombies, zombies who feed.
Yeah, zombies who hunt people. Yeah, I think
with
that's
oats.
Right. Yeah.
They hunt with oats.
I feel like this is going somewhere. Wasn't this episode of Walking Dead? Didn't they get led into like a bread factory?
Was that what it was?
Terminus, a bread factory?
Yeah, they left out little chunks of bread, and the whole gang followed them, like nibbling on the Wonder Bread, and then they led them into a bread factory, and then the big attack happened.
A bread factory.
Wait, isn't that the plot of The Hills of Ice 2?
Right.
Sounds like you're talking about Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah.
is this question answered? Because I have no idea.
I think it is.
Okay. I think we answered it.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know how.
Pretty well. Eskimo? Come on. How many Inuit zombies have you seen?
Okay. Yeah. We answered it. I don't know how.
Wait. What about 30 Days a Night?
Oh, crap. No, those are vampires.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no zombies. That's right. Fair. That's fair. But it's close. It's like adjacent.
Yeah. If the zombie froze and got tired, it could pass for a zombie. Oh, man, I'm cold. And it's a zombie.
All right, Mark. I think I'll kick it back to you for the final part of our discussion about Wes Craven. That was a good segue. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, kick it back to me. You know, hopefully I don't blow a hammy.
Yeah.
And so we're just going to blast through a few movies here. Hills Have Eyes Part 2, one of the worst cash grabs of all time, 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. It tells a story of dirt bikers who get lost and go, na 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 na, you can't catch me, to the deranged mutants. A dog has a flashback. And it's terrible. From there, we get Deadly Friend, where the only thing that's notable, actually read John's review on Movies, Homes, and Flicks, but Christy Swanson smushes the lady from Throw Mama from the Train's head with a basketball.
And Goonies,
and her head gets smushed, literally, by a basketball.
That movie is Young Frankenstein meets Weird Science meets Short Circuit meets Reanimator.
Perfect. And her head gets smushed by a basketball. Anything else, Love and Good?
I mean, other than the fact that movie is, like, utterly ridiculous, like Deadly Blessing was ridiculous, this was ridiculous. Because, like, a kid in the mid-80s develops a free-thinking robot with the technology in the 80s, and somehow he's not, like, rap video bitches and hoes deep. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? He's not, like, crushing zombies into his food so his poop sparkles. He's, like, just a college kid who who's a prodigy and made this robot. Like,
he's not Ex Machina.
And he's teaching lectures. Like, I wonder if Miles Dyson is in these lectures, like, so that later Miles will go, like, make Skynet.
And a head gets mushed with a basketball.
In the most ridiculous surprise ending, the most irrational surprise ending. You know, if Wes Craven had three bonkers movies, it would be Nightmare on Elm Street, which he hit on the mark with his zaniness, like all the weird stuff that happened with the telescoping arms, the tongue coming out of the phone, the maggots being out of the chest, and the face impression in the wall. It all worked, right? But then you go back to, like, Deadly Blessing, Hittites that are transgender, there's snakes, there's chickens, there's tarantulas, there's ghosts, it's all over the place. This was like in the middle with the zaniness, but it was a lot of fun. I really like this movie. It's a blast to watch. You'll laugh a lot. I think it's on Netflix.
Next, we have 1987's The Serpent and the Rainbow. And I love what Ebert said about it. He said, the visual look of the movie is stunning. There's never a sense of sets, of costumes, of hired extras, but more of a feeling of a camera moving past real people in real places. Even the obviously contrived scenes, including some of the hallucinations and voodoo fantasies, have an air of solid plausibility to them. So,
you know, back in our Romero pod, we were talking about how pre-Romero, all the zombies were, they weren't flesh eaters. They, you know, because Romero made that flesh-eating zombie that we know today, that thing. And before that, it was like this voodoo mysticism kind of thing, and just like being risen for acts of revenge. Well, this is like the one zombie-ish thing that he did, and it was mysticism. It wasn't that weirdness. It was the weird zombie approach. It was the zombie that used to be with a more modern filmmaking approach, and no one was doing that after Romero. So it's like Wes Craven said, don't do what other people did. And he makes this movie that touches on zombieism, like coming back from the dead. And then he does it in the classic way that no one's doing anymore, yeah, which was kind of cool. And it had Bill Pullman in it, didn't it?
Yeah, he's the best.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Like you said, like what Ebert said, it has an air of just legitimacy to it. It feels real. It feels grimy. You feel the sweat. I don't know. I like it. I wouldn't call it Wes Craven light. I would just put it Wes Craven different. But
that's like him going out of left field. Not like bonkers left field, like Deadly Blessing and Deadly Friend and stuff. But it's like him almost deciding to do a foreign movie. I don't know how to explain it better than that. It felt like another world.
It's not Diet Sprite. It's Sprite Remix.
Like, yes. It's Coke Zero.
Right.
It's New Coke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah.
And I mean this thoughtful, grimy movie, Serpent and the Rainbow, people are like, I'm going to go watch a zombie film. And then they see this and they're like, huh? So that could have backfired a little bit for Wes there. And the next film is the campy, bonkers, insane. Oh, wait. That's next. The next one, Shocker. John, what podcast did we talk about this on?
You know, it wasn't that long ago. It was in our Random Awards, episode 25. It was about our midway listener question through the podcast where we went up, down, left, and right of all the zaniness of Shocker.
That's right. And it tells the age-old story of a serial killer that gets sucked in becomes electricity, like the electric gremlin. And a funny fact about this, they were like halfway through making the movie, and the guy who did the special effects kind of went insane. And like Wes is like, hey man, when the effects happen? He's like, yeah, they're coming. Hey, you know, when the effects happen? Yeah, I got them. And then eventually the dude just lost it and quit. He just went crazy and disappeared. So Wes and his son had to like go through his car and all these things and get all these reels for the special effects because his special effects guy lost it.
It's funny you say that because a similar thing happened, although not directly to Wes Craven, during either the second or third Elm Street movie.
The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, where they were scrambling to find things, and that was one of the – oh, it was Freddy's Revenge. And Freddy's Revenge, which Wes Craven helped write, but he had no part in direction. A lot of the movie, there's no glove. And so they improvised and made it so – since it was like a body horror movie, like the claws were coming out of the guy's fingers because he eventually comes out of the guy's body. But it turns out it was because the special effects guy – hadn't yet made the glove. He never finished the glove. So that was, even though it turned out cool and appropriate in the movie, that's what happened in that movie too. All these effects were delayed, and they were filming all these scenes with the special effects later, and even then they didn't have all the effects. So I thought that you were talking about the wrong movie at first, and then I remembered that about Shocker as well.
I mean, wow. People go crazy on these films. Like, Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, shot in 27 days, which is incredible. And if you think about all the special effects, like, that crew got worked. Like, you know, working on films, I think that would be a nightmare to be on that shoot. But so maybe he did. Maybe the – and he wrote – which Freddy are you talking about? Three? Dream Warriors?
It was part two. It was Freddy's Revenge.
Well, he wrote that, I guess. So, so our next one is the bonkers – the crazy, the people under the stairs, 1991, which tells the age-old story of a bunch of inbred folks who worked at a crematorium, made a bunch of money, then they bought real estate. Now they are landlords in an inner city. And a boy named Fool is up to him to foil Mama and Papa, the inbred brother and sister, and their cannibalistic children, who are freed at the end and run out into the night to do who knows what.
That was one of those movies where when I rented that, like, at Blockbuster or whatever local video rental store I had back in, like, 92, 93, I thought it was really cool, and I was, like, 11 or 12. I thought it was so awesome and weird. And then I saw it again, like, in my 20s, and I'm sorry, Wes, but I was just kind of like, this is dumb. It was... But you know how I said The Hills Have Eyes lost its impact for me, but I still appreciated it for its historic value and what it did for film? Like, the people under the stairs, it neither impacted me, nor did I even see anything to appreciate in it when I watched it again. That's the one Wes Craven movie I can really say that about, I think.
The one thing I love about it is whenever I have a friend that buys a house, I always send him that movie. Nice. When you got your apartment, I sent you that movie.
What if they lived in a one floor?
Well, like, there were no stairs.
In Florida with no basement.
I mean, it's there. Yeah.
Like, they're in the sinkhole underneath.
Yeah, exactly. If you live in Florida. And, but yeah, so People Under the Stairs, you know, it was during Reagan's era, so we kind of, like, based it off that. It got political, but he also, it was his attempt at, like, Gonzo. And I don't know if that was ever his strong point. And, I don't know. It's just a weird film, and I don't know what those cannibals did when they got those little children did when they got released at the end. I mean, they're all just gonna wreak havoc. I want to see the sequel where they have to round up all those kids that escaped from the house.
Well, maybe they're all grown up now.
All these feral kids,
yeah,
just unleashed on a neighborhood. That sounds terrible.
One of them grew up to be Dan DeVito in Batman Returns.
You know, those pale weird kids, I'll bet they'd turn into the war boys from, like, Mad Max Fury Road.
I love it. And Ving Rhames was in it. He got wiped out pretty early, though. But it's just a weird movie with, like, weird BDSM and inbred people. And it's an interesting Wes Craven film. It is a cult classic, though. It has become a cult classic. And the next film we're going to get to, I want to spend a little bit more time on, is Wes Craven's New Nightmare. The 1994... beautiful meta film that led to something huge in 96. So, Levengood, you want to talk about New Nightmare?
Well, you know, first I'll point out that this is the first Freddy movie he directed since the original, which leaves five movies in between that he, you know, the first couple he just had a part in writing. Once he got to, I think, part four or five, he was almost uninvolved. So this was pretty cool, though. You know, they made a new approach to Freddy. They kind of regret the glove.
Break down the plot?
Well, you know, the plot, quite simply, is that it's real life. It's a meta movie, this movie. And so in this movie, Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp are real people, not actors. And Freddy, through sheer virtue of the fans believing in him, comes into existence. He manifests through that belief. And then, manifested with the belief that Nancy dispatched him in the first movie, he's coming back for revenge. And of course, he's going to aim for her child too.
And you know what I love? There's a scene with Wes Craven. He's like, the only way to kill Freddy is to make more movies. Like, I love that. Like, Like, I love that he took it back, and this was like Mad West Craven again, and this was like a crazy idea, and this is once again him putting a new spin on something old. He created Freddy, and then he went, and then they ran Freddy out of, you know, ideas, and then he reinvigorated Freddy.
Yeah, and you know, all the regrets that I ever read about this movie that Craven had just were aesthetic. They were just the glove. They were just the makeup. And, you know, if I was looking back, I thought they were a little off, but they're the only things that I'd raise a brow at. I love the story. I love the execution. I love the different approach. I liked how they made Wes Craven appear in it, because when he's contacted, like, everything seems normal on the phone, and he's just giving his kind of, like, zen or philosophical idea. Like you just said, like, you have to create more movies if you want to end him. You need to properly end him. And then, like, the camera pans out to a wide angle from him on the phone, and you see he's making this grotesquely macabre, like, dark artwork.
Oh, that was Englund saying that.
Oh, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. Yeah. But like, the way they depicted him, like, it was really cool. Like, they're just doing this.
He was like a professor. And I have two random observations. This movie features one of my favorite elbows of all time. Yeah, Langenkamp is being held by this nurse. And when her son and, you know, Julie gets killed in the hospital, the babysitter, and Langenkamp's trying to get to her son, and the nurses are holding her, and she just goes, poof! She, like, throws her elbow to the side and hits this poor female nurse right in the gut. And the female nurse goes,
okay, first off, in the Freddy series, you never, ever trust nurses. It's a fact.
Yep.
Okay.
One thing I didn't say is Lynn Shay, our favorite Insidious woman, was in the first Freddy, and her brother Bob Shay produced Nightmare on Elm Street. But Lynn Shay was in New Nightmare and the first Nightmare on Elm Street. Sorry.
I think she met her husband there. I don't think that they were involved at the time.
No, they're brother and sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be weird. So they met.
They met before.
Yeah, they met before. Hopefully they didn't, like, you know, have,
hi,
like, a weird situation.
I'm your brother. Nice to meet you.
But yeah, so, and then there's another thing where this is going to sound weird, and but I've worked on a lot of sets, and I hate commercials and films that show sets because they're never right. Like, there's a scene in New Nightmare where the guy who gets killed by the glove, he's sitting in his prop truck, and in the background there's a massive, like, 18K light that's on, but it's during the day and it's on for no reason, which would never be like that on a film set. So, every movie about film sets always annoys me. So that's, like, my only gripe. But I loved how meta it was, and I love how you had to kill him by making more movies. And I thought there were some genuinely terrifying set pieces. And that poor little kid from Child's Play, that kid gets put through the ringer. And I think most importantly, it opened the door for something huge. The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yes, I was about to say.
Did you like New Nightmare, Lazabeth?
I mean, I haven't seen it in a while. I didn't rewatch it recently, so I didn't want to comment on it too much. But I remember being scared when I was a kid. That's all. Nice. Maybe a little bit confused because I was really young back then. I was like, I don't know what's going on.
I've actually been doing a rewatching marathon, and I'm on just finished 4, so I haven't seen New Nightmare in about 10 years.
Imagine if that's the first Freddy film you watch. You're like, what the hell?
It wasn't my first Freddy film, but it was, I remember it was the most confusing one to me, because it's just like, wait, what's going on? Like, why is he, like, the same character or something? I'm just like, I don't know. I was a pretty dumb kid back then.
Yeah, well, I watched it when I was like a teenager, like, and it went over my head, too. I was like, why is he not killing co-ed?
Just get to the death scenes already. Those are the cool parts.
Well, I don't know why when I was a teenager I spoke like that. Just kill the co-eds.
You did. You did.
Yeah.
You're also like 30 pounds heavier. You had like a beard. You were smoking stogies every day.
I'm aging in reverse.
Yeah. You're a Benjamin Button.
Wait. Oh, man. That means I'm in trouble. That means I've lived more life. Crap.
Yeah, you'll be all right. You'll be all right.
But so next, Vampire in Brooklyn. Big flop. You know, a lot of problems with the studio. Eddie Murphy didn't want to play scary, so it was just like a weird hybrid. He played a lot of characters, you know, but see, he didn't want to play like joke. He was so self-conscious. Then he went and did Nutty Professor, but this is definitely,
Wes Craven wanted him to be more gruff, more brutal and at the same time more funny. And Eddie Murphy wasn't willing to do any of it.
Yeah. See, this is what I need from you. Gruff, rough, and tough. No.
I can do funny.
And can we talk about that hair that Eddie Murphy had? He had the same hair that Van Damme had in Hard Target.
You think that's what Eddie Murphy was going for? I'm going for Van Damme.
Van Damme and Hard Target. Hard Target, 93, 94. They're both wearing trench coats.
Put that down, John. Write it on a piece of paper and put it in the non-existent file cabinet
It's like if Van Damme became a black New York vampire.
Didn't he have to find a wife?
Yeah, he needed to find a bride, and it was Robin Givens or something. Angela Bassett, I'm sorry. Yeah, Robin Givens in Boomerang, yep. Which came out like a year or two earlier, and the movie posters are almost identical.
It's like I felt bad for Angela Bassett in this movie. I'm like, you're so good. Get out of here. Just pull up Freddy's New Nightmare.
She deserves
just run
better.
Away. Yeah,
St. Pete like, native.
He put her Saint music in the Pete. Heart after this, so that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, music to the heart. Do you guys want to talk about that?
Well, I just want to spend the rest of the podcast on Meryl Streep's violin lessons.
Yeah. Just kidding. Let's not do that.
All right. So 96, Scream.
Minor movie. Some people liked it.
So we had the 70s revolutionized horror, 80s revolutionized horror, and 90s revolutionized horror. Kevin Williamson took New Nightmare to new levels, and he created very likable teenagers who are self-aware of horror films. Not only did he make it funny, but he made it brutal and mean. I mean, the beginning of Scream is a brutal opening. Like, it's brutal. Like,
it definitely sets the tone for not that movie, but just the entire series in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like Drew Barrymore gets murdered. She gets hung up and, like, gutted. And then her parents see it.
Plus the fact that it's Drew Barrymore, it's like you never expect her to be taken out in that fashion. It's like, oh, no, it's that little girl from E.T.
Yeah, you know what I love? Yeah. Drew Barrymore wanted that role.
Really?
Yeah, she said it would be more like it would get people bigger if she died as the first character.
Well, no, that was really cool of her because it definitely – she took one for her team. Literally.
This is going to sound weird, but whenever we talk about that scene, I always think about that scene from Scary Movie where they spoof it. And you know, the popcorn's going. And he's like, the killer's like, what is that? She's like, oh, I farted. And he's like, no, what's the other noise? Oh, she's like, oh, popcorn. Juvenile humor at its finest. But no, I mean, that's a brutal move. Like, I love, and you know what, though? I love it. Like, I think it's the perfect blend of a very self-aware, on-his-game writer and a horror director who has seen it all and is down to create something different. Basically spoof what he almost started. With Nightmare on Elm Street, and I love it. I don't know.
It paved the way for all the teen slasher flicks that were soon to follow in its wake.
Yeah, it's like a good and a bad thing.
Yeah, but you can tell something really hit it on the nose when you have like so many imitators. I think what made Scream so good was that it was just like it knew like. It obviously knew what it was kind of, you know, I don't want to use the word parodying, but just kind of basically the tropes that it was trying to just make fun of. But at the same time, it also embraced the tropes somehow. You know, it was making fun of, but at the same time also celebrating. And it was just like, if you're a horror movie fan, Scream was basically just kind of like a love letter to just like all the movies you watched over the years. And it was a very satisfying movie to watch, you know, every time.
And I thought out one of my favorite line from the film when Matthew Lillard is like stabbed and he's bleeding and he goes, "My mom and dad are gonna kill me."
Yeah, you Sydney, you called the cops. My mom and dad are gonna kill me. And
that was improvised. That was improvised.
Yeah, yeah. The stabbing with Skeet Ulrich and Matthew Lillard. I liked them back then, and now I like them even more. And Jamie Kennedy.
He was also awesome.
Wes Craven was saying, like, he could just let Jamie Kennedy go and say whatever he wanted, and it was, like, gold. So a lot of it was improvised, and how cool is that?
Yeah, and what I love is These actors have never been better in movies. Jamie Kennedy, Matthew Lillard, David Arquette, and Courtney Cox.
Yeah, fan, like Malibu's Most Wanted.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah.
Hey, you got a GameCast? it's either GameCube or a PlayStation. Well, I don't know, man. I got no money. But I got no money. But they've never – and the chemistry between Courtney Cox and Arquette, like, just is so great. And Neve Campbell's, like, one of the best, like, final girls. Like, she's just kind of, like, earthy in the role. I mean, it goes back to his beginning days. I mean, the performances that Wes Craven can get out of his actors is unparalleled. And sometimes it's a bummer to watch these movies because I know how good that, like, Kennedy and Matthew Lillard can be and David Arquette. You know, and, like, it's like, man, these guys could have had better careers. But Scream – and so this I'm going to move on to a theory here, and I'm writing a post about it, so I don't want to give everything away. But I think Scream 2, pound for pound, might be one of the best horror sequels ever made.
Really? What makes sense?
And that's because Scream happened, right? It was a success. Kevin Williamson did have like 10 pages for it, but they're like, hey, we need a movie and it needs to be released in a year. So they had to write, cast, find locations, build sets, film. Then they had to edit, market, and release in 1 year.
No small task.
Based on that, can I just ask, when you watch this, if you didn't know anything about making the film, would you call it the best horror sequel? Or is this, like, more holistically from a filmmaking perspective?
All right. Yeah, that's a good point. There are better sequels. But I think from a filmmaking perspective, I mean, their script got leaked, so they had to rewrite everything. This is a movie that got set back 2 months in a year because of script leaks, and it still had a great ending. It's a capable film. You know what I love most about Scream 2 is it doesn't just bring back the characters who you love and just let them run around. It builds every single character in this film. You know, you find out, you know, Jamie Kennedy gets his moments to shine. David Arquette and Courtney Cox grow as a couple. Dewey grows as a man. Neve Campbell kind of grows up. Like, it doesn't just let the characters stay static in a cash grab. Now, don't get me wrong, this movie was a cash grab, but it's one of the most successful cash grabs of all time. And if you judge it with other movies like Paranormal Activity, Saw, Hellraiser, sequels that took place a year afterwards, it's rated 30 points higher critically in audience average than any other movie, that horror movie that was released a year after its original. So, I mean, obviously Dawn of the Dead, Evil Dead 2, I think are better films. But I would argue that Scream 2 is for what it is and the time it had, is amazingly successful and self-aware.
That's a thesis right there. I like that.
I'm going to have to put this post out like tomorrow because someone's going to hear this.
Would you still say the same about the other Scream sequels?
I love Scream 3. I think it's funny. Parker Posey makes everything better.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where the killer throws the knife, and instead of the blade going into Dewey's head, the butt of the knife hits him in the head.
Yeah. It's a good thing Kurt Russell wasn't there.
Yeah. And Scream 3 was by a different writer, Aaron Kruger, as opposed to Kevin Williamson. And there's very funny moments in it. Like, there's a scene where they're in this house, right? And the killer turned off all the lights, and Dewey has a gun, and Courtney Cox comes up on him and goes, ah! And then another woman comes up on him and goes, ah! Then another guy comes up on him and goes, ah! And, like, it's very knowingly self-aware with the jump scares. The kills are crazy. Like, the people who survive smell the gas, and then the one guy puts the lighter on it, blows up the house. I mean, you know, I think for a third film of an entry, Scream 3 is kind of perfect as a comedy.
right.
But I don't think it's horror at all. I think it's what Kevin Williamson didn't want was his movie to be zany. He wanted his movies to be mean. And if you look at actually his TV shows, The Following, all those other things, they're grimy little shows. So you can definitely see the difference in Scream 3 from Scream 2.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I love the opening of Scream 2 with Omar Epps and Jada Pinkett. Timothy Oliphant in it is the human, what did you call him? Ferret? Who's like one of my favorite, we're not making fun of, Mongoose. He's a mongoose.
That's right, sleek mongoose.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that Wes Craven did a brilliant job on Scream 1, 2, and 3.
It was interesting. Scream was his third time kind of battling with the MPAA rating board.
Really?
Yeah. So, well, back with we talked about Last House on the Left, right? Well, then
last
when
house,
he came
wait, to, Last House on the Left, right?
We talked about that and the hurdles he had with the Nightmare on Elm Street. He had trouble with the R rating because of a lot of the graphic death stuff and just the nature of Freddy. It was too off-putting. And then he kind of pulled off the same thing that Spielberg did and with the MPA rating board with Poltergeist, which got him a PG rating with Poltergeist. But so Spielberg was saying, look, all this stuff that happened, it's the family. They're saving the family. The family's whole again. And the most horrific scene where the guy's picking apart his face, he told him, yeah, but it didn't really happen. Later you see him and he's fine. He just imagined it. And they're like, well, your Spielberg will buy it. Well, what he did with New Nightmare was he said, guys, it's all a dream. And then all of a sudden, when he just said that it's all a dream, these are in dreams, and he said it's all a dream, as if the whole movie was potentially a dream, even with the way it ended. So he's like, yeah, when people see it at the end, they'll realize it's all a dream, so they won't be so freaked out. Well, with Scream, what happened is all the graphicness and adding humor to it, people were off-put by it in the rating board. But it wasn't until after attempt after attempt after attempt where they wouldn't give him an R rating that he said, guys, it's a spoof.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they give it to him. And then they just say, okay, just cut 5 seconds of Matthew Lillard's dripping bloody hand because running blood isn't good, but blood is okay. But once they said spoof, they're like, oh, okay, fine, R rating. So it's interesting seeing the amazing level of arbitrary judgment in the MPAA rating board.
I love the back and forth and goes, guys, it's a spoof. And they're like, oh, yeah, just cut that blood off Lillard's hand. You guys are good.
Yeah.
But before that, it was like, no, this is too brutal. And the human nature behind it is too contrasting. It's too weird. And then, guys, it's a spoof. All right, we get it now. Cool.
Peace.
All right, guys.
Where are you guys going?
All right, guys. Before we wrap up this podcast, I want to ask you a quick question. What was your favorite Wes? I was about to say Wes Anderson. Yeah, it's just... What was your favorite? Same here. What was your favorite Wes Craven movie and why? If you had to pick one, if someone was holding a gun to your head, it's like choose a Wes Craven movie now and just one.
Scream 2.
Really? Really? Scream 2.
I love that he made it work with a year. I don't think that's possible for a lot of filmmakers. And the performances he got... You care for the characters. I do think there's better films he made, but the fact that this guy could pull off what he had in under a year blows my mind from a filmmaking perspective.
All right. No, I can respect that. Loving good. What about you?
Okay, look, 34-year-old John would say Nightmare on Elm Street. However, back when it was released, I was way more thrilled by Cursed because I was 23 years old. And Cursed was Cruel Intentions with werewolves.
And flicking off werewolves. Werewolves flick people off.
But, like, everyone was attractive. Even the gypsy was Portia de Rossi, which was a nod back to the old Wolfman and the reference of Silver. And there's Maya and Shannon Elizabeth and Christina Ricci. And it's nodding all the old movies. It's got all these attractive people. They're needy. They need space. There's all the relationships. It was Cruel Intentions with werewolves. And it was... If Cruel Intentions in 1999 was your senior year in high school, well, Cursed came out right after you got out of college and were getting a job. It was the perfect age.
Yeah. So
it was Cruel Intentions with werewolves.
Those two movies are basically life markers for you, Love and Good. That's weird. In a good way. In a good way. Okay, we got Scream 2. We got Cursed.
Portia de Rossi's in both.
I think for me, I gotta go with Music of the Heart.
Meryl Streep got an Oscar nomination.
Cloris Leachman was also in that. I felt like they were a pretty good duo. And yeah, I'm gonna go with Music of the Heart. Check it out. I don't know if it's on Netflix. I know Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is.
Watch Red Eye if you get a chance. It's
we didn't really do
Hitchcock.
We didn't really talk too much about Red Eye, but that's also a pretty decent movie.
Oh, yeah, and your brother really liked My Soul to Take, which was his only 3D movie, I think.
And like, all right, so I just want to read something. I know we're going long, but here is a couple dialogue scenes from My Soul to Take between the Ripper and Brandon. She's not here. Well, where is she? Where you're gonna go? I'm gonna go to church. No, you're not. What do you mean? No, I'm not. Think harder. Miami? Try hell.
I like the voices now, that Mark does. You're going to be great reading the stories to little kids one day.
And then here it is. Another one. Ripper. Anybody you want to say goodbye to? My unborn child? Sorry for the language. Oh, gosh. Fuck your fucking unborn child. Now where'd I leave your bitch? My Soul to Take is a very weird movie, guys.
Mark, do you want to do the plugs in that voice? Please.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
All right. So, all you bitches out there, head to movies, films, and flicks, or go to hell.
You sound like an R-rated WWE wrestler.
Listen to Shark Dropper. Listen to Paralyzed. Listen to Top 5. Listen to Snubbed. Listen to Word of the Bay. Listen to the music from Music of My Heart.
Oh, watch Kimmy Schmidt. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Listen to Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix. Don't watch it. Listen to it. Just turn your back from the TV and listen to Kimmy. Listen to her Schmidt.
You've never bitches. Seen you've never seen that show, have you?
I watched the first two episodes.
Oh, okay.
Wait.
What? What was that voice?
Wait, who was that?
I don't know.
Who was that?
Hey, what? Who were the hosts of this podcast?
Hosts.
Scary sounding dude, yeah.
John Lazabeth. John Livingood. And for Mark Hoffmeyer, a.k.a. The Ripper. Music of the Heart. Pull a hammy.
I'm picturing The Undertaker right
Kurt
now.
Kurt Russell.
Goodbye, everyone.
Basketball death.
All right, we're done.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! 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 This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.